This is the third time we've been privileged to publish Andy Ilichinsky. In Lenswork Extended No. 64, we published an article he wrote called 10 Epiphanous Photographs. And then a portfolio of his photographs appeared in Lenswork Extended No. 71 entitled Spirit and Light. This time he's back with an entirely new body of work called Microworlds. Andy's a very interesting guy, a very productive photographer, obviously. He's a physicist, and he has, shall we say, an ironclad mind, which he applies not only to physics, but also to his photography. And his mind is manifest not only in how he photographs, but what he chooses to photograph. That is to say, in this body of work called Microworlds, he photographed... Well, I should let him tell you what he photographed. It's an amazing story of creativity, of artistic vision, and of the passion that I believe is the soul of a true photographer and artist. So here's my interview with Andy Ilichinsky, recorded in April of 2008. First, the very first question I need to ask about this body of work is, what exactly are we looking at, and do we need to know that when we look at them? What is it that you photographed here?
Well, that's actually a very interesting question, one that I wrestled with for quite a few days as I was writing the introduction. I asked a whole bunch of friends, some photographer friends and my wife, and I actually went against all the advice. Almost to a person, they said, Andy, don't tell anybody what it is. Just let them look at the photographs. And in many ways, that's exactly what I tend to do. I don't like to give titles to my photographs. I don't like to explain anything. For me, the equivalent of fingernails on a blackboard is when somebody looks at a photograph and there happens to be a tree somewhere, and then they come back after 30 minutes or so, if I'm lucky that they're looking at it that long, and they say, oh, what a lovely tree. That somehow really grates on my nerves. So it goes against the grain, but for some reason I felt compelled to say it, if anything, because the photographs, I think, are so bizarre. And I hope it's not unlike what most people have ever seen or thought about, that by having the explanation, if anything, paradoxically, it makes it even more interesting. I may be wrong about that. So I did struggle with it. And the answer to your question, and it's given in the intro, in the written version, is what you're looking at is a very, very small world defined by a roughly triangular, but it's sort of, imagine a triangle and then it sort of extends in 3D, acrylic candle holders, two of them, mostly. I'll get to why the mostly part in a second. They're about 2.5 to 3 inches tall, maybe 2 inches on a side, and that's it. And they're filled with these trapped air bubbles, and that's basically it. It's a tiny little world. Some of the smaller spots, in fact, I should say some of the larger spots that you see, the larger circles, are roughly the equivalent of maybe a quarter of a fingernail. So you're really looking at not quite microscopic, but certainly small enough that for all intents and purposes, if somebody were to see it in real life, well, it's an object all to itself. It certainly doesn't possess anything other than, well, it's a candle holder. Let's move on. And what I tried to do with the camera is give a sense of the fact that you really do have worlds within worlds. And that was another potential working title, that you can see so much. And that's, of course, what one of the points of being a photographer is, to identify and to show people something that perhaps is not ordinarily seen, or at least at first glance. So that's what you're looking at, a little tiny microcosm contained within a 2.5 by 3 inch acrylic candle holder, two candle holders.
Well, what's particularly fascinating about that is this obviously small in stature subject material gave you enough information and enough potential to photograph, what is there, 70-some-on images in this?
I think I sent between 70 and 80. All told, I have between, it's a good thing both of us are sitting down, I think between 2,000 and 2,200 shots.
Holy moly.
And now I should correct that slightly. Most of them are of those two candle holders, and by most I mean maybe 60 to 65%. Now, the rest of it is kind of an interesting story in its own right because it has lots of interesting anecdotes. What I tried to do is recreate that feel, the visual feel, within a similarly sized container, but with other objects. And so what I did over the course of many, many weeks, the whole project took maybe about three and a half months, I scoured all the local stores and trinket shops for little vases or vases or candle holders with very thin glass, within which I put a variety of substances, from hair gel to hand lotion. I found particularly effective, I don't know what to call it, like Afro hair gel.
Uh-huh. Right.
So but basically various gels that sort of look like some of the interesting parts that I remembered from the candle holders. Now, by far, the majority of it were those, but interspersed throughout, there are a couple of shots here and there from other similar-looking micro-worlds.
Yeah. You know, it makes sense, too, looking at these photographs, that this would fascinate you, because I know, which our readers will know in just a second, that you're a physicist by nature, so the idea of looking at the micro-world to you is not an unknown sort of process.
Right. That's how I approach, or how I have found myself to approach photography. My specialty in physics is something called complex systems theory and nonlinear dynamics. In a nutshell, it's sort of a view of nature whereby you don't focus on individual things, but you focus on the gestalt, the patterns and patterns of things and the way they're connected. So the focus becomes not so much, you know, the world is populated by things that we then apply some taxonomy to, but to try to understand the whole organism and the processes that take place there. And so, at least in my mind, I don't know, other people sometimes are confused by it, but there seems to be a very natural parallel between the very technical end of things, and there's wonderful mathematics and computer simulations you can run to understand how natural systems work, with how my mind's eye, my aesthetic eye, puts together images and what they mean. I tend not to take pictures. By the way, I remember in a recent podcast of yours where I started laughing when you mentioned you had gone with a friend of yours. I don't remember the name, but the fellow who takes these wonderful labyrinthine shots and then that he composes.
Mm-hmm.
And you went somewhere in some kind of park, and on a podcast you said how you were approached by one of the park rangers or something. They're asking what you're doing, and, oh, you're photographers. We can use that in our store, something like that. And you said, you looked at each other and said, well, what we tend to do is to not take pictures of places that tell people exactly where the pictures have been taken or something of that,
right,
of that ilk.
Right.
And I can very well resonate with that because I tend not to take pictures of things or of recognizable objects, even though they're recognizable objects in the photography. To me, the field of view of my camera is this literally like a palette of forms and tones and textures, something I learned from my dad, who was an artist. But it makes use of what I do in my day job, my physics, because I tend to work with patterns and basically, you know, so the mathematical equivalents of textures in a very different way, of course, but that's how I approach my photography.
Well, Minor White said years ago, you know, that the real key to photography is not photographing what something is, but photographing what else it is.
Right.
And
right.
In this case, you've taken a relatively mundane thing in the form of a candle holder and turned it into a cosmos of its own.
Right.
These are not only micro worlds, as is the title of your project, but in some sense, they're galactic worlds at the same time.
Right. And of course, it's up to the imagination and the creativity of the viewer to fashion a world that fits what they see. And it's also interesting to me as a physicist, as a mathematician, the reverse engineering problem and sort of the almost the metaphysical repercussions in the sense that here I have in on the DVD, you'll have like 80 images. I've said that I have something over 2,000 of these little micro worlds. And yet, no matter how many shots I take, I mean, at some point, of course, there will be inevitable repetition to a degree. But I basically have 2,000 perspectives on a particular world, the collective of which gives me a fairly good idea of what it is, but not completely. And there's always something missing. And it's so beguiling that it's such a tiny little world. And how much more so must that apply to the everyday world we're familiar with? You know, we tend to think that, well, we all know what the world is and what it consists of. It's what we see, what we breathe, where we walk. Well, it's a lot more complicated than that. And you can find immense complexity even in the tiniest of spaces. And for me, that's one of the reasons I really, really enjoyed this project. It continues to have philosophical ramifications for me.
I remember in one of the very early classes that I took in physics in high school, one of the exercises we were given was to describe a pencil. And we were given an entire class time to come up with as many descriptive statements as we possibly could. The purpose of the exercise, of course, was to educate us that it's not the pencil that is limited, it's our ability to visualize it and describe it and to think outside of our own limitations. And that's essentially what you've done here in an artistic sense with this subject material.
It's what I've tried to do, yeah. And I've really enjoyed hearing different people describe what they've seen or what they think they've seen before I explain to them what it is. So again, for some people, it may be unfortunate that they're sort of given the answer up front. And it would be a very interesting process to go through for anybody, I think, to go through these images and really ask, well, what am I looking at? Going back to your first question, I'm not sure what the correct answer is. Should or is it better for somebody to know or not? And I really am not sure. I mean, both will lead to different reactions, and that's as it should be. We have, you know, different takes on what we see given the information we have and the context we're in. But I've certainly enjoyed hearing people struggle with, well, what is this? And what am I really looking at here?
Well, one of the important elements of this that is interesting to me, because I would not have suspected this until I heard you describe what you photographed, and that is, these things are not moving. The assumption would be that they are, that they're water, they're ice, they're splashes, they're something like that, and that you've captured them with stroboscopic photography or some such thing. But no, these are literally frozen in time, encased bubbles, shapes, patterns, and whatnot in the plastic or the gel.
They have a remarkable degree of fluidity and the viscosity. You can almost feel it oozing in and out, and it's completely static. Yeah. Even those cases where I was talking about the gel, I mean, it basically settles, and I wait for it to settle, and there it is. And I take another shot of a static object, and yet it has this very dynamic feel to it. Yeah. And I love that dissonance.
When you mention that you've got a couple of thousand photographs, the two questions that immediately come to mind is, why do you have 2,000 of them, and how did you edit from 2,000 to 80?
Oh, boy. Well, the first answer is very easy. I just couldn't stop. And in fact, the setup that I have, and it's fairly rinky-dink. I mean, there's nothing sophisticated. I took over our dining room table, and I spread out a couple of pieces of black and then white and then eventually colored paper that I got from a CVS sort of for the background and tinkered with different lighting. But it's basically just a baby setup on a dining room table. My wife is used to those things, so I knew I was okay in that regard. And it's still standing. I finished the project back in January, and even though I moved on to other things and it sort of sits in a corner, it's still there. And in fact, this past weekend, I set it up yet again, and I took a few shots. It's very alluring, and it has the quality of, oh, there's one more shot that I haven't seen yet, but I know is there somewhere. And more often than not, I surprise myself. And after all, that's, in a sense, that's the basis for why the project arose in the first place. The way I put it in the intro is, and it's very true, I mean, the way it started is we were sitting down to dinner, and my wife took out these candle holders that we've had for years, that was given to us for a wedding more than a decade ago. We may have used it in the past, I don't know, I honestly don't, but I certainly don't remember ever seeing it with the photographer's eye before. So she brought it out, Halloween, I think, and plopped it on the table, and I was instantly mesmerized, because in my mind's eye, in a flash, I anticipated what sort of bore fruit, this infinity virtually of compositional possibilities, and it has persisted since then. So I'm still taking pictures. So the first part of the question is easy. The second part is, in a sense, easy, but I don't have any clear insight into exactly what went on in my mind. I can just tell you from a practical standpoint. I mean, everything, of course, is done digitally. It's stored on my computer, and I every night I would sift through however many and put aside and continually shuffle from what I like, what I don't. Sometimes one image would be in the pile that I really, really love for a few weeks, and then I'd keep staring at it. And it's sort of like the old exercise of putting photographs on a wall and living them for a while. Mm-hmm. And if you tend to live with it for a while, well, maybe there really is something that strikes your eye and there's something deeper. And it's the same process I played in my computer. So it was tedious. But there wasn't any particular insider, you know, there was no one key moment. Sit down and start saying, well, all right, I'm going to chop it off at 100, and I'm going to go through these one last time, and that's it. it basically just self-organized. At some point, I ran out of steam, in a sense, and I wanted to put together a portfolio for myself, really, and no other reason, to see if I could really come up with some series of images that hung together, that told the story, were both similar enough to know that they came from the same source, but dissimilar enough that different people could find different images that would speak to them, and yet they would still be along with the series. And just some magic day in January, whatever I had in my keep pile, it numbered about 80 or 90, and there you have it. What deeper process was at work? I don't know, but that's part of the joy of photography. That feeling that you have as you're doing that, apart from that incredible feeling, of course, of pressing the shutter, I think that's like the quintessential moment for a photographer, when you have that enormous potential, not yet realized that, oh, this is the shot. And of course, most of the time it doesn't really work out. But the second moment for me is really a series of moments where I live with these images over a period of time, and I let them settle into me, so to speak. And at the end, sometimes, not always, out pops some portfolio of images that I'm happy with, and then I move on.
Yeah. Yeah, very interesting. Now, this is all obviously then deep macro work. Describe to us a little bit of the equipment that you're using.
Very simple equipment. I use one of my older cameras, the Canon 10D, and it's basically been sitting around as a backup. And I had a nice Canon 100mm macro lens. It's sort of an unsung hero of Canon's lineup. It's not an L lens, but it's about as sharp as one. And it's really, really nice macro, particularly on a 1.6 crop for the digital. And that's essentially all I use, a little remote to trigger it, and a tripod, and that's about it.
What about the lighting?
I bought a basic set from a local pen camera store for photographing, like eBay things. You know, you have a little diffuser and like a little compartment where you can put things, and I played around with that. So again, nothing very fancy. The total cost of the extra equipment was about $60.
So this is continuous light rather than flash.
Right, right.
Well, that does help the composition just a little bit.
And I tinkered, as I said, with different backgrounds, because as you see, obviously they're all black and white. I have a few color that I actually prefer in color, but I used a different backing just to help a little bit with the separation, color separation for the black and white images. And I just played with different colors, green, red, so on.
Yeah. We did a portfolio in Lenswork Extended not long ago from a fellow who photographed spiderwebs.
Hmm.
And we haven't... we haven't published spiderwebs before. They're a little bit cliche for the fine art photographic world. And
it must therefore have something special if it made it into Lenswork.
Well, it did. And what it turns out that this fellow was doing was using a piece of recombinant software that allowed you to take a macro photograph, similar to what you've done, at various focal points. So he could focus on something at the backside of his mm-hmm. macro image and then pull back the focus and make another exposure, pull back the focus and make another exposure. Right. And then the software combines all these various exposures mm-hmm. into one image using the sharpest part of all of them.
Oh, that's interesting.
So he was able to essentially use software to increase the depth of field, and it gave a very unique image to what is a very old and sort of worn out subject material. Maybe I shouldn't have mentioned this to you.
Well, yet again, yeah, here's more information that we now have to go on, and the context is different. Although it brings to the table all sorts of other questions we probably don't have time to go into, just the nature of modern day photography, sort of the next step beyond the old cliched problem of, well, at what point in your manipulation of an image do you actually start walking so far away from what you've tried to convey of the reality out there that it becomes a graphic image? So here is something that could not conceivably be done, except under particular circumstances, in the film world before the digital technology.
Mm-hmm.
Yet it permits you to take what almost paradoxically is a more accurate reflection of the reality in front of you, but it's completely digital. So, I mean, there are a variety of interesting issues there.
Yeah. Well, with your images, for example, there is a shallow depth of field on some of them. You can mm-hmm. see it in the various objects that are in the field of view. But, of course, as human beings, we don't see that way because we tend to naturally focus things and then assemble the sharp image right. in our mind's eye. That aberration of optical photography to create a false depth of field is something that we've learned to accept by seeing photographs, really.
Right, right.
But it's interesting how some of your images here have that shallow depth of field look. Some of them do not. Mm-hmm. And some of them, they both work. That's what I want to say. Some of them that have the shallow depth of field work because of the shallow depth of field. Some of them that don't have the shallow depth of field work because they're not shallow. And if they were a shallow depth of field, I doubt they'd work as well.
Right. Getting back to the actual act of taking these macro shots, in point of fact, most of these images actually took a while, even though it may seem kind of funny. You know, people, well, Andy, you're taking a picture of something, you know, as I said, 2.5 by 3 inches and 2 inches deep or whatever. Some of these images took quite a while to compose because I have this enormous space to play with.
Right.
Yes, you know, I, as you say, some of them have fairly sharp focus, some don't. Some have a very deep depth of field, some don't. And I had that whole volume of space, which, of course, when magnified by the macro lens, it truly becomes a world. Well, it's almost as if I'm standing in front of my three-dimensional landscape, and I have an enormous variety of aesthetic choices to make. Should I sharpen this particular otherwise fuzzy-looking ball somewhere on the right as opposed to one on the left? You know, should I rotate it just a couple of degrees here and there? Should I change the light or bend down the neck a little bit? And all of these variables have to come into play, and of course they quickly and exponentially start multiplying. So there are many images there that would take me sometimes half an hour, if not more, for that one image.
Yeah.
To find something that, oh, it clicks. And then just like in the real world, standing in a landscape, you're moving your camera around, you say, ah, there it is, and you go click. And those moments were not always very rapid. In fact, more often than not, they weren't because of the enormous space you have to play with.
You mentioned that this was photographed primarily on your kitchen table.
Mm-hmm.
That requires the patience of your family.
Oh, God, yes.
And I understand your dad was also an artist, so you have a family of previous generations to influence your work, too.
My dad, yeah, he passed away a few years ago. He was a lifelong artist, not a photographer, although he did take pictures for a while, but more to cater to his art. By trade, he was an art restorer, the old-fashioned one, never used computers. In fact, I know he never knew how to use them. I can tell anecdotes about me sitting him down in front of a computer where I finally set up a website for him about a year before he died. And he was absolutely amazed, and he couldn't understand how everybody around the world could actually be looking at the same thing. But that's sort of another story. But yeah, my dad, he was a lifelong artist. I am completely self-taught, but in a sense, I had a teacher my entire life. I mean, I would hang around, and art is art, and composition is composition. If I know anything about photography, or if I have any aesthetic sense at all, clearly whatever is innate is innate. But I would argue that a large fraction of whatever it is that I apply to my photography was taught to me by my dad, both explicitly and me just watching what he did. And my home actually is filled with many more of my dad's artworks than my own photography. So he taught me quite a bit. As for my family, they are very, very understanding, particularly my wife. We have 2 young kids. 1 is 9, 1 is 5, and they're very rambunctious, and they're boys. So they need lots of attention. And we both try to provide it, but my wife goes way beyond the call, and she sits patiently with the kids and tends to them while Daddy is off photographing. Sometimes I take one or both of them with me. The older one in particular, Noah, he's been going on my photo safaris ever since he was a little tyke. If I have time to give 2 quick anecdotes, I think one is very apropos for this story because it involves these micro worlds. To set up the context, in a sense, for my son, and we'll get to the micro worlds in a second, go back maybe 3 years or so, 4 years, and he's already a seasoned veteran with going out with Daddy, and he's used to Daddy taking pictures and sort of remote areas and taking shots of stuff that most people would walk by and never really pay much attention to. And the way Noah characterized it many years ago is Daddy likes to take pictures of garbage. That's what he would tell people. And so I remember very well, I was taking him home from preschool one day, and we're just sitting at a red light, and I see this gleaming eye of his when he's about to make a joke or something. It was a young tyke, 5 years old at the time. He leans forward at this stoplight, and I say, yes, no? He says, Dad, take a look to your left. And I look, and I confess I didn't really see much. And then he comes out with, "Dad, look, there's a bunch of garbage cans over there. Don't you want to grab your camera and take some shots?" So that's just the sort of set the context that Noah's very well aware of my predilections and my eye. And even though he makes fun of it, he truly knows my aesthetic extremely well. And so now we go back or go forward a couple of years and we go to Microworlds, right smack in the middle of my project. And it's a typical Sunday. I'm in my usual position, sort of back-breaking position, huddled over my tripod trying to compose these things. And both my sons know not to run around, to upset the tripod and stuff. And so my younger one, Josh, he's off playing in another room. And I hear the small, gentle steps of Noah from the kitchen to the dining room. And he has with him an orange. He comes in very quietly, doesn't upset anything, settles into a chair, doesn't say anything, and I'm clicking away, and I just hear at first the peeling of the orange, and then he quietly starts munching on it. It goes on for about a minute or two, and then he finally, as I come up for air, he looks at me, takes a bite, says, "You know, Dad, I used to think you're kind of crazy when you're taking pictures of all that garbage." And he remains silent. I look at him half expectantly, and I say something like, "So now you realize it's all in the name of art after all these years." Takes another bite. I mean, he probably has a comedian's future in him. The timing was perfect. And he goes, "No, Dad, this time I think you really lost it." Takes another bite and goes back to watch SpongeBob. So it's an illustration that my family, I think, by now is very used to me taking what to outside eyes would be sometimes very strange pictures and doing strange things. But they're very used to it. They even have a humor about it.
Well, particularly when one does 2,000, as you mentioned, photographs of this, it requires not only the patience of your family, but a little understanding, I think.
Yes. Most of that has to go to my wife. She's just been tremendous. I mean, without her help, I wouldn't have any time for photography at all.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of amateur photographers out there know exactly what I'm talking about.
Well, other than in lens work, where has this work been shown?
This is very, very new. The only place is actually in a self-published book on a self-publishing site called blurb.com. It's fairly new, and that's kind of a conversation in and of itself. I'm working on a couple of projects, one of which involves my dad. I mentioned that he passed away a couple of years ago, and I'm trying to slowly put together, with my mom's help, sort of his life's history and his life's work. I have lots of digitized pictures of his artwork, although sadly, because this was many years ago, I had to use a much lower resolution camera. So I'm not sure exactly how I'm going to go about that. I'll probably have to rescan a lot of my older slides. But anyway, I ran across this company called blurb.com, and I've been startled by its quality, actually. It's been in existence now for a couple of years. It doesn't do photo books exclusively, but it does photos. And it does it remarkably well. I think it stands up very well to some of the sort of middle of the road, let's say, photo books you would see on a border shelf or Barnes & Noble. It's nowhere at, of course, what Lenswork is at, or the better reproductions that you see in the better fine art photography books. But for what it is, it's extremely good. So as a test case, I put together a photo book, and I liked it so much, I actually put a couple of them together. And in one of them, called Landscapes of the Soul, there are four portfolios, and one of them is this Microworlds. So mm-hmm. that's actually out there now.
And people can find out about this on your blog site.
I have a link to it on my blog, yeah.
Yeah. Tell us about your blog a little bit, too.
The blog is an outgrowth of a website that I had created for myself many, many years ago, and I've just not had any time to update. And I was looking into ways of doing that kind of thing a little bit faster with faster turnaround. I really ought to get back to my website, but I started a blog, and initially it was just a place for me to keep track of some notes that I wanted for myself, because I tend to have lots of ideas scattered here and there, and it gets a little cumbersome to write in the notebooks I would carry with me. So I wanted a place on the web where I can jot down my ideas. And it eventually blossomed into sort of, you know, the typical thing you see on a blog, but I hope filled with a little bit more substance and depth on musings on the creative process, as it were. But it has lots of my most recent photography, not my website, but actually the blog. And it's just something that, even though I don't do it religiously every day, there may be four entries a month, let's say, they tend to be fairly long and thought out when I actually do get to it. And it's just something I enjoy doing. And it also jumpstarts me a little bit. And I've been doing that now for, I think, 4 years or so.
Yeah, it's very good. I've enjoyed it a great deal, actually.
Well, in fact, The first time I was published in Lens Work, I don't know if you remember, it was a response to one of your essays where you wrote about, I forgot exactly what, but it was something like, what do I tell people when they ask me, why are you a fine art photographer? Why does fine art photography interest you? And I sort of converted that question into what were my 10, as I call them, epiphanous photographs. And I wove that into a two-month project on my blog where I carefully sat down and I thought about, well, who are the photographers that most influenced me? And I wrote 10 essays. And I sent a link to the forum that you used to have. In fact, I wanted to ask you a question about what happened to the forum. You guys should bring it back. And I guess you saw the forum and then you sent me an email, would you be interested in us publishing this? And of course I was. But that originated on my blog.
Yeah, well, it was very well thought out, very good thing. And I think that, in addition with the Spirit and Light portfolio that showed up in Lenswork Extended 71, people can get a chance to see more of your work. You do a lot more than just macro work, obviously.
Yeah, they're very, very different works. Although the one unifying theme, and perhaps it's a nice way to circle back on the physics, the unifying theme is serendipity. The Spirit and Light, which is a bunch of photos I took in local, by local I mean Northern Virginia, Washington, D.C. area, Orthodox churches, Russian Orthodox, Bulgarian, Ukrainian, and it happened completely by chance. Many, many years ago, I had entered a jury contest at the National Cathedral, and I got in. In fact, I'm proud to have, I think they still have two of my works that are hanging in an upper gallery. So week after week, this is like in 2003, 2002 even, week after week I'd slug my way to the cathedral and I'd start trying to find angles and compositions. And I found it enormously difficult. Truth be told, I found the place very sterile. I come from a Russian Orthodox background. It had nothing to do with that. It's just that was my reaction to the physical layout of the cathedral. It was very difficult for me. Mm-hmm. But I did that for many, many weeks. And virtually every time, because I'd be coming from the Virginia side, I'd be going up Wisconsin Avenue, and there on my left-hand side, about a quarter mile before I got to the cathedral, there's this beautiful Russian Orthodox church, St. Nicholas. And I passed it day after day after day. And I'd go there in the morning on weekends, and I'd always make a note as I'm looking to my left, wow, what a beautiful church. I really ought to stop by and look at it. And by the time I had finished taking pictures of the cathedral, I was so dog tired that I always said, oh, next time, next time. Well, the next time never came. And there was a lull in between projects about 2 or 3 years later, and it just suddenly occurred to me, out of thin air, so to speak, well, Andy, there was that beautiful church you saw. Why don't you, you know, go and take a look? So I did, and that started me on a six-month project where I visited all the Orthodox Church, completely by chance. And then, of course, the story with the micro worlds, again, completely by chance. I mentioned in my introduction that on that particular day, I was wandering around one of my favorite haunts here, which is Great Falls, up a little north from where we live, maybe 20 miles or so. And I was taking the usual variety of, you know, the rocks, the water, the trees. And it was both exhilarating and it was very frustrating because there was nothing new coming out. And in my usual diligent way, in my notebook on that particular day, I looked at the entry when I was writing this introduction for all these neatly thought out musings about, and they're all sort of all technically written and worked out and worded. Perhaps this should be the project. You should examine this. You should examine this. All meticulous, right? Mm-hmm. I'm sitting down to dinner, and none of that panned out, of course. And all of a sudden, my wife brings out these two candle holders, and there it is. For the next 3 months, that's what I'm consumed by. In fact, I did very little photography outside my dining room for those 3 months. That had nothing to do with the fact that it was cold and miserable outside. I mean, I love that kind of weather. But it was purely by chance. And so the way it goes back to my physics is I mentioned that my field is complex systems and nonlinear dynamics. That's essentially what it's all about. The degree to which randomness is actually not so random, but has latent order. And that is sort of the whole crux of what nonlinear dynamics is, mathematical tools and simulation tools to uncover what to the untrained eye is simple random maneuverings and random gyrations of molecules. In fact, there's a persistent but very subtle order, even what appears completely chaotic. And it, in a sense, I'm learning that, even though I shouldn't, and I'm embarrassed to admit it, but I'm learning that through my photography, because most of it is induced by chance, or more by chance than by a self-defined order.
Well, many photographers have come to the conclusion that the real task of photographic, well, composition in particular, is making order out of the chaos of the world. Maybe your implication here is not so much making the order out of the chaos as discovering the order that's not so obvious at first glance.
Right. The next question, of course, becomes, is this an order that is only observed or understood by me, or is it something that I can communicate and has a more general and universal character? And I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. There's an interesting and very thin sometimes line between what other people perceive as order, what you perceive as order, what you all understand and agree as order, and those things which forever remain hidden, no matter what the photographer likes to do or what he or she thinks he or she sees and what other people see. But that's what makes the whole thing fun.
Well, and these photographs are a part of that very process. The last 15 seconds that you just described, that order applies perfectly to these photographs. They're just wonderful. I'm so glad that you decided to not only allow yourself to be captivated by the candlestick holders, but that you photographed them and submitted them to Lenswork, because it gives us an opportunity to share it with all of our readers. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. I welcome the opportunity, and it's not something I planned for, as I said, but I hope it does represent something that most people have not really thought about as a photographic opportunity, and yet it is.
This whole idea of photographing the mundane that surrounds you every day in your life is a theme that comes up from time to time, because photographers are always bemoaning the fact that they have to run off to, you know, Yosemite or some grand right. landscape. And eventually every photographer rebels against that and says, no, I want to photograph here in my house. And what they end up making a lot of times is, you know, really sort of boring photographs of the towel on the bathroom floor kind of thing.
Right.
But you've actually found something that's literally a part of your house, literally not underfoot, on the kitchen table, in which you discovered an entire world, and that itself is an incredibly creative act.
Well, it brings with it, this is perhaps my Russian blood getting in the way, we always tend to look at things as half full, or half empty, I should say. It was an exhilarating thing, and I think it ranks right up the top at some of my more memorable and enjoyable projects. But with it, this is the other part, it brings the inevitable realization that this is going to be really hard to duplicate. And, you know, lightning can only strike once, that kind of thing. I know that's not true, and of course, if I'll be alive for a few more years, I'll have other things that I'll likewise discover, probably in a serendipitous way. But there is that inevitable feeling. I mean, it probably happens to almost all photographers for all the projects, but for some reason, for this one, it was particularly striking to me, because I so enjoyed it. I didn't want it to come to an end, and why I think I still keep this thing out, because I don't want it to come to an end, even though I'm taking fewer and fewer photographs. But I still go there. I don't want it to end, because I know that if it does, well, what else am I going to find? You know, am I going to find something? Is this it? I don't tend to spend too much time worrying about it, but it does eat at me after a while, because I recognize myself that this truly was a little gift that just sort of sprouted from nowhere, and I tried to seize hold of the opportunity.
Well, seems to me like you've got a pattern that you've already described, which is the thing that is speaking to you, that's right underfoot, that you may not be paying attention to, that's literally right before you, whether it's the church that you photographed, whether it's these candle holders. Maybe it's as simple as paying attention to what's right before us, and if we photographers did that more frequently rather than chasing around the countryside looking for things, we might make better photographs. Who knows?
Oh, that's a valuable lesson. I try to remind myself of that every day. It's very hard to put into practice, but the first step is to remind yourself that is so. And to put yourself in that frame of mind, I think it helps. The last anecdote I'll leave you with is, but you have to picture this in your mind's eye. I can only describe it for you. And I've had several incidents like this, but I'll just give you one. I mentioned that among those that were not specifically the candle holders, but were sort of on the aftermath of that, when I was trying to find these gels to put into little glass containers, I spent a fairly long time on my knees squatting, looking at the lower shelves at a particular CVS near my work, in the Afro gel section. and I'm looking at these cans, and you can imagine what I'm doing, right? Mm-hmm. I'm picking them up, I'm holding them to the light, I'm very nearsighted, so I have to take my glasses off, and I have to put them close to my eyes, so I make this comical figure. I'm squatting on the floor, I don't have an afro, I have a full head of hair, but I obviously don't need this product, at least, you know, if you look at me and you're standing there, as indeed someone was. There was this very nice elderly lady, she was with a walker, she looked to be 80 plus, and she was just politely and silently standing about a foot and a half or so away from me squatting. I finally get up, she looks at me, and almost as if, I mean, it literally was like a take out of Ghostbusters, if you've seen that movie, where they're up in this corridor up on some high rise, and one of the characters just fired into a cleaning woman's, you know, her work stuff. And this lady looks at me and says, "What the heck are you doing, young man?" And I had to explain to her, or I tried explaining by saying, "Well, ma'am, I'm a photographer." I don't think that really made much sense to her. She slowly waddled away. But that's the price you pay for trying to find the right material.
Oh, us artists, we're just goofy. Well, thanks again, Andy. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Likewise. Thank you very, very much.
Copyright 2008, Lenswork Publishing.